Dear friends of Jesus Christ, the Gospel of Matthew tells us that when Jesus saw the crowd, he went up a mountain, and after he had sat down, the disciples came and gathered around him, and he began to teach about the kingdom of heaven, the inauguration of God's rule. He said, Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who are poor in spirit. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness' sake. Blessed are those who are merciful. Blessed are those who are pure of heart. Blessed are those who are peacemakers. Blessed are those who are persecuted for my name's sake. Blessed. Fortunate. They're on the road. They are near the Messiah. And then he said, you are the salt of the earth. And you are the light of the world. And then he said something very, very important. He said, I did not come to abolish the law. I came rather to fulfill it. And Dan Brunner says, to fulfill the law, understand that to mean that Christ came to fill the law full of obedience and meaning. Because Jesus says, those who are citizens in my kingdom, their righteousness, their justice, is to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. It's to exceed their righteousness. And then, beginning with verse 21, he gives six illustrations, situations, how that looks, what that looks like, a righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. And so we have these six contrasts, and we'll be looking at each one for the season of Lent, where Jesus begins by saying, you have heard it said. You've heard it said, you shall not murder. You've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. You've heard it said that anyone who divorces his wife must bring a certificate of divorce. You've heard it said, you shall not speak falsely. You've heard it said that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And you've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. And in each case, Jesus says, but I say unto you. Two things before we look at the first of these contrasts. The first thing that strikes you, even I think as we hear it now again, is how much Jesus puts himself in the center of it all. I mean, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, we're told that the people are astonished, are amazed at what they have heard. Pope Benedict, in his discussion on the Sermon on the Mount, says it's a translation that misses the point. It's not that they're amazed, they are alarmed. They are shocked by the way Jesus enters into this contrast. And then the Benedict, what he then does is he references a book that was written by a Jewish theologian, a rabbi, by the name of Jacob Neusner. He wrote it, I think, back in the 1990s, A Rabbi Talks with Jesus. Neusner is very sympathetic towards the Christian faith, has a great deal of respect for it. Lots of Catholics and Protestant theologians are his friends, but he's a believing Jew. And so he takes time to write about his conversation with Jesus. And at the end, he's asked, well, what did Jesus take out? And the nurse says, nothing. Well, what did he add? And Nursus says, himself. And then he clinches it by referring to Jesus' call to follow me. This is the Messiah who is speaking. This is the anointed one of God who comes to inaugurate the kingdom, the shalom for which Israel has been waiting. So first of all, the significance, the centrality of Jesus. The second thing that's significant, I think, is how Jesus doesn't, it's not like, you know, you say, don't kill, and I say kill. That contrast is what goes on. It's rather that Jesus takes those things that have been spoken of old and then intensifies them, deepens them. He, as it were, penetrates the command to its very core and exposes the heart of the command. So that David Kelsey, I've quoted him before, but he's very, very good on everything he says. And he when he talks about the Sermon on the Mount and these contrasts, he sees what Jesus does as giving us what he calls exemplary demands, which portray in example the manner and radicality in which God demands obedience. So not to see them as separate laws, so that Jesus becomes more relentless, becomes meaner and stricter than the Pharisees and the scribes, but rather he looks at the law through the lens of the double commandment to love God and the neighbor, and so both deepens them and positivizes them. So, the first thing, Jesus says, you have heard from of old, you shall not murder. And the word is murder. It is the intentional, unlawful taking of another's life. I say to you, Jesus says, that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be liable to judgment. If you insult a brother or a sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say, you fool, you will be liable to the hell of fire. So Jesus, in his deepening, in his interpretation of this Mosaic law that comes to the people from Mount Sinai, he says, it seeks not only to protect life, it seeks also to protect the person. The person's identity. You shall not be angry. When you trace wrongdoing back to its core, we often find anger there. Now, I know, and we're not going to go into that, but that there is an anger that is good. I mean, there is at times a call to be angry. But we're talking now about anger that is tainted, and it's often tainted with malice and hate. So that when we're angry with the sin, we secretly despise the sinner. We have disdain for the sinner. It's very difficult to be angry and not to sin. Anger is a very dangerous weapon that we all possess and all practice and use. If I were to find out that you were angry with me, for instance, your anger would be wounding. It would be wounding. And very likely, I would examine what I was doing and try to change if at all possible. And if I couldn't change, it might very well evoke a great anger in me. In any case, it would create stress. It robs shalom. It robs of shalom. Anger. To be angry, to lash out. Why are we angry? I mean, wouldn't that be a good question to ask just by ourselves? What makes us angry? I suppose if I were to ask, say, a third grader or a fifth grader, when you get angry, why is it you get angry? They might say, I get angry when I don't get my way. Lou Smeads, in a wonderful book on 1 Corinthians 13, says, at the heart of our anger lies erotic love. And by erotic love, he isn't talking sex. He's talking about the love that needs. It's a love that desires. And all of us have erotic love. We all need. We need security. We need to be affirmed. We need to be included. We need to be acknowledged. We need security. We need all of these things, right? And when those needs are thwarted, in small ways and big ways, anger is kindled. It can happen in the smallest little things, like traffic. Somebody is slow in front of you, or doesn't go when the light turns, or the food is cold, or the service is bad. We can become quite angry. Smeads on this talks about the fact that many of us live feeling irritable. He says irritability is the launching pad for anger. And I think he's right. I mean, I think you all know of times when you have felt irritable. So then when you entered the situation, you got home, the kids were loud, or whatever happened, you blew. And everybody think, oh my gosh, what's the matter now? But you were irritable. You were launched to attack, to strike. It's not only with people that we can become angry. We can become angry with the lot that we've been given. We can become angry with God. We think God has done us a bad turn to be angry. I remember one time my mother and I were talking, and I said something about a friend of hers who I said seemed always so happy. And she says, well, no wonder. The wind's always in her back. And she was saying, her wind is not always coming in her back. Anger. Now what happens with anger is we lash out, right? We wish to screw the person to the wall if we're angry enough. We wish to drop dead. Maybe we would not say it, but we ignore the person. She's no longer in our life. They're no longer part of my group. Jesus, when he talks about this anger, sees it oftentimes turning into its very near cousin, contempt. And contempt, not only as an attitude, but in language. You fool, you empty-headed fool. You jerk, you jackass. And I'm just being very gentle. but we use words, isn't this right? We use words to express our disdain. And by using these words and describing them as being fools or whatever, what we have done is we've excluded them. We've excluded them from belonging. I mean, I think that this works. I think it works throughout, you know, our lives. But I think it happens very much in school. And some kid is designated as a jerk or as strange, and that person is no longer accepted. The great need to belong, the great need to be affirmed, is robbed from that person. And Jesus says, when you call someone a fool, when you disdain someone, when you dismiss that person, you are liable to judgment. And if your righteousness is to exceed the righteousness of the Pharisee and the scribe, then that attitude, that kind of language, that kind of disdain, contempt, anger must be extracted from our lives. Jesus says, so when you are offering your gift at the altar, and you remember that your brother or sister has something against you. Now, this is very interesting. It's not at all clear here who's done the wrong. I mean, here, if you remember that somebody may have something against you, so it's not that you have something against that person, but here suppose you said, you remember that somebody may have something against you. Well, Jesus says, leave your gift before the altar and go first be reconciled to your brother or sister and then come and offer your gift. A couple of things. The first thing is that this contrast here underscores Jesus' huge emphasis on reconciliation, on being reconciled, right? The second thing is that there's such exaggeration here, because Jesus is giving this talk, this sermon, in Galilee. And he's talking to these Galileans, and he's saying, now, when you're at the altar, ready to go to the altar with your offering, and the only place that these folks would have an altar would be in Jerusalem. So the picture is somebody traveling 80 miles to Jerusalem, ready to offer the lamb that he has brought or bought, and then something occurs to him. Somebody has something against him. So Jesus says, tie the animal up and then go back to Nazareth or wherever you're from, make amends, and then come back and offer the offering. Now, obviously that's an exaggeration, hyperbole, but it underscores that our cultic activity, our religious activities, are trumped in a way, but by our moral and our ethical and our Christian lives. So that it's not the case that, well, this is so important that everything else has to wait. No, this is so important that the worship must wait. You know, as I was thinking about that this week, for the first time, really, it occurred to me that's the reason why when we have communion, right, just before we gather around the table, after the breaking of the bread and the pouring of the wine and all that wonderful stuff, there's this, and now pass the peace to one another. And sometimes that seems a little unruly and wild, and it breaks the sort of the mood. And I think sometimes you think, let's not do that. But in fact, it's very much in keeping with what Jesus says here. It becomes, again, a liturgical act which expresses how important it is that we be reconciled to one another, that we do our utmost to make friends of those who have something against us or against whom we have something. I mean, this puts a huge burden on all of us, right? Not to be so angry or so disdainful or so dismissive that we hardly even think about them anymore. Jesus says, you've heard said of old, you shall not murder. Well, now, I'm telling you, Jesus says, in this kingdom, which is a provisional display of the shalom that is coming, anger and disdain and contempt must also be eradicated. And so the question for us during this Lenten season is, well, how does that get managed in our life? How do we rid ourselves of this irritability that we oftentimes feel deep inside of us? How do we become less angry? You see, and then I go back to that wonderful little book by Lou Smeeds on 1 Corinthians. It's of course where the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians has been talking about the gifts the things to pray for, the gift of prophecy, the gift of teaching, the gift of tongues, and all of these different gifts. But he says, you must strive, you must pray for the greatest of all gifts, which is the gift of love, agape. He says, this love is patient and kind, not envious, not boastful, not arrogant. This does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful and takes no delight in wrong. It is this love for which we must pray, because this love is a power that gives us some power over our anger. And you say, well, how exactly does love, agape, this agape love? And here we become very elementary. But it is nevertheless a fact that if the love of God settles on us, we will find that the things we need have been satisfied, so that we become less irritable. There's that famous observation by St. Augustine that, my heart is restless until it rests in God. Well, I think our hearts are prone to rage and anger until it rests in God. The Apostle John says, love casts out fear. Love also casts out rage. If each day again we could acquaint our souls with the love that God has shown to us in Jesus Christ, that would give us a sense of security, a sense of identity, that would make it less threatening when the things we work for don't quite match our expectations. When we feel ourselves thwarted in our goals. But more than that, this love, it also enables us to see other people. Now think of the people that you're ticked off at. It enables us to see them as children of God, as image bearers of God, for whom Christ longs. That they're not just competitors. They're not there to satisfy my needs for self-fulfillment, my needs for happiness. That makes it helpful to not be so angry. And the third thing is this love creates a gratitude in our hearts. We become grateful for the day, for the breakfast, for the friends, for the people in our world. To extract this tendency to lash out, to be angry, to feel disdainful, we must pray each day for the love that God has shown to us in Jesus Christ to be the motivating center of our lives. You know, maybe I'd like to finish by just reading to you what, in fact, the Heidelberg Catechism says as to what it means to be obedient to this commandment. It says, what is God's will for us in the sixth commandment, thou shalt not murder? It says, I am not to belittle, insult, hate, or kill my neighbor, not by thoughts, not by words, my look or gesture, and certainly not by actual deeds. And I am not to be party to this in others. Rather, I am to put away all desires for revenge. I am not to harm or recklessly endanger myself either. Did you know that my father thought that this meant that a Christian couldn't be in a circus? That's how he because it unnecessarily endangered your life. I don't know about the circus, but it does mean you shouldn't go too fast on the road. If you're going to be obedient, not to the laws, but to God. prevention of murder is also why government is armed with the sword. Does this commandment refer only to killing? By forbidding murder, God teaches us that he hates the root of murder. Envy, hatred, anger, vindictiveness. In God's sight, all such are murder. Is it then enough that we not kill our neighbor in any such way? No. By condemning envy, hatred, and anger, God tells us to love our neighbors as ourselves, to be patient, peace-loving, gentle, merciful, and friendly to them, to protect them from harm as much as we can, and to do good, even to our enemies. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.